SF Signal Episode 60, Lou Anders interviews Michael Cassatt and David Goyer. This is the SF Signal Podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And this is episode 60 of the SF Signal Podcast. And we have a very special treat for you. Lou Anders is a Hugo-nominated editor, a Chesley Award-winning art director, a PKD Locus and Shirley Jackson Award-nominated anthologist, and is the editorial director of Prometheus Books' science fiction and fantasy imprint, Pyre. David S. Goyer is the Academy Award-nominated screenwriter of the blockbuster films The Dark Knight and Batman Begins, and Michael Cassatt is one of the writers of the classic Twilight Zone television series and an author of over 30 science fiction and fantasy short stories. Lou talks to them tonight about Heaven's Shadow, a new book from Ace that should be out on July 5th, and this is the first book in a trilogy that'll be followed by a book called Heaven's War and another one called Heaven's Fall. And the premise of the series begins like a disaster movie. But you know what? I'll let them tell you all about it. So here's Lou.
For our listeners who may not have gotten the wonderful press release we got, can you tell us the premise of Heaven's Shadow?
The premise is, it takes place when? 2017?
Yeah, about 6 or 7 years from now, 2 or 3 years after the discovery of a massive near-Earth object passing through the solar system, close enough to Earth to be reachable, but not close enough to be a threat. And two teams of astronauts, one from the United States and one from an international coalition, are basically racing to be the first to land on it. They land on it and discover that it is not exactly what they thought it was going to be.
Yeah, they sort of a new space race happens between the Americans and this coalition of other nations. And there's a lot of saber rattling that goes on. And these two teams end up having to band together to, one, prevent possibly an international incident. But when the, I think we can say this, when the orbit of the near-Earth object changes, there's an assumption that it is under
control,
exactly. And so this might be possibly a first contact scenario then. So the mandate of the mission changes as well.
So that's the setup in terms of the science fictional terms. Since we are actually storytellers and novelists and things like that, we also want to note, because it's one of our goals, that it's actually a human story of redemption and revival in some sense, because the lead character is a NASA astronaut who was scheduled to command one of the 21st century return to the moon missions a couple of years prior to the start of the story. His wife was killed in an accident just before the mission. He was taken off it, sort of went off to mourn and then recover, and so he has become the commander of this mission, and so it's the chance for him to put his life back together, he thinks. And, of course, it doesn't go the way he plans.
And hopefully, in the grand tradition of some of the better science fiction novels, it's also an attempt to at least answer or explore some of the bigger theosophical questions that are facing, you know, us as humans, using science fiction as a, you know, way to explore metaphorically or not so metaphorically ideas, you know, would otherwise be impossible to explore.
So there's your press release.
Yeah. Maybe that was too long-winded.
No, that's wonderful. And you actually have touched on some of the other things I wanted to ask about. One is, you say this takes place 6 or 7 years from now, and our lead was scheduled to be on the return from the moon missions, but the Endeavor has just flown its final flight, and it looks like we're scrapping our space program pretty seriously. Do you take that into account? And what are your personal feelings about the current state of the space program?
Well, scrapping the space program completely happened, you know, after the ship had sailed, no pun intended, on the novel. The novel had been written and was, I think, in galley's form by that point. when the Obama administration pulled the rug out from under us. But
well, there are different ways to look at that as well. First of all, the number is almost arbitrary. We just wanted the story to be set as close to the future, as close to the present as possible, because it's not about the world on Earth, it's about the world beyond the Earth. And so rather than get into the debate and development of, what is life like on Earth 2030, 2050, we just thought we would set it as close to the present as we could.
The day after tomorrow.
Yeah, so there is that. So yes, when we conceived it, there was the Constellation program. As someone who actually is probably a little more into this and more inside baseball on it than most people, I never thought for a minute Constellation in any form was going to be flying anything in 2018 to the moon or anywhere. It was completely underfunded. It deserved to be canceled and junked in favor of something else. So that's a whole set of other issues. But it does use the same sort of hardware and architecture. A lot of the material, very fine work that went into the concepts for Constellation are things we mined pretty completely for our project.
It was important. I mean, there are kind of two different types of science fiction stories. There's a science fiction story that takes place, I guess, in a far distant future or entirely on another world. And there's a science fiction story that takes place more or less in the world of today that injects a single science fictional element into that world, which tends to be more of the approach that someone like Michael Crichton, used to do.
Or for that matter, H.G. Wells. Wasn't that his rule?
Exactly.
Just change one thing.
So our attempt was to create science fiction story that was as relatable to the lay audience as possible, but also mine science fiction, tropes and themes.
And this is first of a trilogy, correct?
Yes.
So how much do you reveal at the end of book one?
Well, without spoiling too much, we certainly reveal what the Neo is and who or what may have sent it and why it's here.
And what the big problem is, but there are a lot of stories are resolved. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think for us also, one of the issues with first contact stories is that they historically tend to have fallen into one of two camps. An alien invasion, a la Independence Day or something like that, which are, while exciting from a logical standpoint, seem pretty unlikely because it's a long weighted journey just to, get some water or get some real estate or something like that. And then the other camp that they tend to fall into is the 2001 camp, which is here's a test that the human race needs to pass in order to join the cosmic club. And we were trying to come up with a third scenario, a plausible scenario for why, intelligent life might need to or want to contact us, which, again, without giving too much away, ends up involving the climax of this book.
Well, you have me intrigued with that statement, because I was going to ask whether we were leaning more towards 2001 or Avatar, and it sounds like you're trying to split the difference.
I would say, yeah, it's not Avatar in the sense of we're not literally going to another world, another culture, and exploring it on its home turf, so to speak. But there are certainly aspects of it, because I, frankly, this is Michael, I like the complexity of Avatar compared to, say, most first contact stories. I like the fact that you're actually dealing with an alien culture, and we certainly get hints of that.
Mm-hmm.
2001 and Clark is clearly a model for us, because Clark, let's face it, he pretty thoroughly mined that basic theme a number of times and a number of ways going back to the 40s. So you're, in essence, you are building on or answering Clark no matter what. But I've always thought that a lot of the characters weren't particularly rich, and the storytelling wasn't particularly innovative or dramatic. And so, yeah, we're trying to have the synthesis of both.
Wouldn't you say that Rendezvous with Rama is a more apt antecedent to this book.
Clearly. I mean, in fact, Rendezvous with Rama is something I literally read probably 35 years ago or even longer when it first came out. And when we started working on it, I just had the feeling, well, you know, that's dealing with an object entering the solar system. Aren't we just following Rondo with Rama? But then again, I kept running across other stories that, in essence, had used the same mechanics, because if something comes into the solar system, you are inevitably going to do, you know, to follow a certain type of story. But yeah, Rondo with Rama is probably more of an antecedent for us than 2001.
Well, that kind of leads into a difficult question, which is Rendezvous with Rama was 1972. And I'm sure you both heard the old adage that Hollywood tends to run about 25 years behind literary science fiction. You know, the Matrix was brilliantly rehashing ideas that Philip K. Dick and William Gibson did 15, 25 years earlier. And that's okay for the broad target of a Hollywood blockbuster. But in the literary field, I know that Heaven's Shadow is going to be a film as well as a book. For audiences, what is new isn't necessarily new for the core of science fiction readership. So what are you bringing to the big dumb object being discovered on an Earth, you know, trajectory that people haven't seen before? On the novel
side. I think we have a pretty damn good twist in terms of what Zach, who is, you know, our protagonist, our main protagonist, and the other astronauts find inside the Neo that I can't really think of any time that I've seen something exactly like that.
Yeah, since the major twist was David's idea, and the initial drive for this project was David's, I'll say to him, for him, yeah, it was a pretty good idea. When I heard it, I thought, okay, I haven't seen this done this way before. So at least conceptually, the SF game playing thing, we think we've got something new. But the real thing, I think that shows an evolution from something like Rendezvous with Rama, is to us it's a human story. Mm-hmm. The thing that I think I brought to it was the ability to kind of get in the minds of the explorers and make them more realistic astronauts than you have tended to see in even in, you know, fairly recent science fiction literature. And in fact, I think we've emphasized more the human story than the science fiction spectacle, although on the surface, and you look at the cover, you look at the press releases, you look at what, you know, the artwork, you're not necessarily going to see that. But our idea is that, and as you know, Lou, science fiction, to use Greg Benford's term, science fiction that is tennis with the net up, you know, very rigorously thought out, plotted, conceived science fiction, has a tough time making the transition in literary terms or reading terms to the bestseller list. If you put a vampire or a zombie in it, yeah, that's one thing. But we tried to do something that...
Straddles both worlds.
Straddle. So, I mean, you just call it either synthesizers, clever synthesizers, or blatant straddlers. But we're trying to go beyond what has been done before.
And I would add, this is David, you know, I had this initial idea that I wanted to explore. And I knew that I wanted to achieve two things with it. One, which was I love science fiction. I also wanted to reach potentially a broader audience than the core science fiction audience, which is not at any stretch of the imagination to say we've dumbed anything down. For me, the key to doing that was providing a real emotional story that would resonate with an audience, whether they were a fan of science fiction or not, to make sure that the emotional story was very heartfelt. But the other thing that I wanted to bring to it was a sense of verisimilitude. I knew that Michael's background with NASA, you know, personally knowing so many astronauts and things like that, and him being so well versed in the space program, he would be able to provide a kind of verisimilitude that would take me years and years to research. And Michael provided that in spades, and it's been great because there's all sorts of little interesting sort of personality ticks and details that you might not normally get relating to the space program, or relating to what it's like to train, you know, for something like this, relating to all the inevitable sort of political gamesmanship that goes on in these kind of programs.
Yeah, it's just the kind of stresses those people are under. I mean, and if you look at the real space program in the last few years, you know, it's inevitable. You've got to say that the Lisa Nowak story, the infamous diaper wearing astronaut, is one sort of guidepost out there. And I was kind of shocked to see the Gabriel Giffords Mark Kelly story having kind of eerie parallels to our novel after the thing was turned in. So I think we're at least in the ballpark in terms of creating that sort of having that fidelity to that world.
There's also little things, like there's textural things that there's a plot twist that sort of hinges or turns upon the fact that the Russian suits tend to have some fatal engineering flaws in them. It's the kind of thing that only Michael or a handful of people would necessarily know about. And it provides a plot twist for us in the course of the novel.
Wonderful. So you seem to be doing a good job of mirroring rigorous hard science fiction with character-based narrative, which if you pull it off, you'll be in a very small handful of people who do that.
Well, there's a reason, because it's really tough.
Yep.
We're huge science fiction fans, and I mean, David has spoken of his love for it, and I've been reading, I think, the best of science fiction for 40 or more years, and there are no major authors and quite a few minor authors that there's nobody on that list that I'm unfamiliar with. So we certainly, between us, know what has been done and what's attempted and what we think has worked well and what we think has fallen short. And at least we went into this with our eyes open and a clear set of what our goals were.
But I'll also say this, that in my experience, adapting Batman to screen and now Superman, one of the things that Chris Nolan and myself tried to do was get people that didn't normally like comic book movies, quote unquote, or superhero movies to like them, which I feel like we've successfully been able to do with the Batman franchise, particularly with The Dark Knight, and hopefully the new one. And so it's an analogous situation where, you know, a lot of times those films have had a kind of core fanboy audience, and the goal with us was trying to see if we could reach beyond that audience and bring in people that didn't traditionally relate to those kinds of films, which I feel like we've had some success with, and to a certain extent try to apply the same methodology to this novel.
Well, I think that is an extremely valuable and laudable goal. You mentioned both of your love of science fiction. Could you each tell me some of your favorites or your influences?
Well, this is Michael. I'll start with the classics, the holy trinity of science fiction: Heinlein, Asimov, Clark, followed by, to some degree, Bradbury and Sturgeon. You know, a little bit less rigorous science fiction, but I've been reading. In no particular chronological order, people like Larry Niven and Greg Bear and John Varley, Alan Steele, I know is one of not only one of my favorites, but David's as well. Jack McDevitt, we like a lot. I've always been heavily influenced by Clifford Simak, a name you'll never hear anywhere these days.
Didn't he write City?
Yeah, he wrote City and Way Station.
And I have read all those guys as well. I have guys that I particularly love that aren't spoken of as often. I'm an enormous Gene Wolfe fan.
Mm.
And I also love and adore Jack Vance.
And I'll throw in just a few other names just because it seems like we got male heavy here, but I'm a big fan and good friend of Connie Willis, for example. I love her work, especially her time travel from England stories.
Did you write Doomsday?
Doomsday book.
Yeah.
Outstanding book. Things like that. So, I mean, talk about there, I would say Doomsday Book as a perfect marriage of a fairly well done science fictional idea, at least applied to a story, with just heart wrenching human drama. And if we got anything anywhere close to something like Doomsday Book, we'd be very happy.
Wonderful. Can y'all tell me a little bit about how you actually write together, how that process works?
We sat down for, I don't know, X amount of sessions and beat out the story. Then we jointly wrote, I don't know how long it ended up being, a 60, 70-page treatment.
At least, yeah.
Something like that. And then it's funny because originally we were thinking of it as a screenplay. And then the writer's strike happened, and it precluded us from the time being from working on it. And Michael suggested that we turn it into a novel.
Thinking of Arthur C. Clarke, we thought, well, yes. Clarke and Kubrick,
exactly.
they developed 2001 simultaneously as a book and a screenplay. So we thought, well, if it's good enough for them, not comparing ourselves to them, but if it was good enough a process for them, it would work for us. And so far it has. We'll see.
And so from that point, we changed the treatment into the first three or four chapters mm-hmm. of the novel and modified the treatment into a sort of outline for the rest of the novel and included a couple of brief descriptions of what the second and third book would be, and then we just kind of ping pong back and forth.
Yeah, primarily I'll do the first draft prosification, to use a horrible kind of engineering term, but David's reading along, rewriting, and correcting me and making sure I don't go too far off the reservation.
And then there's endless revisions.
Many, many revisions, just like film and television.
Yes.
Yes.
Fortunately, none of them for budgetary reasons.
Yes.
Do you find that's good. Do you find that writing it as a film and novel at the same time, that there are things that you cannot do because you've got to fit it into both formats?
Well, there are definitely things you can't do in film that you can do in the novel. The first, obviously, which Michael referenced, was budget, but the second, which is a lot trickier, is it's obviously much easier to get into the various characters' interior, you know, states of mind. And that's a lot trickier in film because it's primarily visual, and at least in a film adaptation, we're not relying on narration.
But I would correct one thing, is we're not developing or not writing them both at the same time. We conceive the story as a story, and then
yes.
try to figure out the best way to tell it. And as David says, there are things that writing fiction, there are tools that you have in the fiction toolbox that are different from what you get in the screenwriter's armoire.
And in point of fact, I haven't actually started the screenplay. We subsequently sold the film rights for the book to Warner Brothers, but we will be well into the second novel, if not even finished it, before I get to the screenplay adaptation of the first novel, which I, you know, hope to be doing some point this fall.
Yeah, we're well into the second book. In fact, the second novel will be done before the screenplay is done. Screenplay for the first one is done.
Yeah.
But to look at it from the other point of view for a moment, David has spoken about the things you can do as a novelist with character and suspending time and getting in someone's head and things like that are difficult. On the screen, but the screen also gives you some tools that are difficult to take advantage of as a novelist, one of which is just the ability to give a setting with 2 seconds of screen time, that in a novel you have to find some clever way to...
Picture says 1,000 words.
Yeah, describe and, in essence, be the camera eye. And it's really difficult when you start getting into science fictional landscapes. And most of this story, most of Heaven's Shadow, takes place in a landscape or a setting that doesn't exist. So it's got to be imagined and described in such a way that allowing for the fact that every reader does create his or her own unique image, you've got to get something that makes sense to the story, and that is a tricky thing to do with words as opposed to a camera.
The other thing is the fact that when I eventually do the adaptation of the first novel, I'm going to have to do a lot of condensing.
Yeah.
Because the novel's longer than if you did a straight adaptation. It's just longer than a normal. It would be a 4-hour movie.
Yeah. At least.
Well, you mentioned that most of the novel takes place in a setting that doesn't exist. That means we reach the object fairly early in the novel.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nice.
Oh no, the novel does some ping ponging back and forth between. I mean, we're approaching the object in the first chapter.
The first paragraph.
Yeah.
You're on approach, but. You know, it's you want to know why you're there. So there's some flashbacks. There's some, some backstories, we'd say, in the screenwriting world.
But, yeah, we didn't want to do, just 90% of the book takes place on Earth leading up to the mission, and then the last 10% you're on the Neo, and then guess what? We've stopped the first book, and you got to wait for the sequel. Easily 75% of the book takes place on the Neo.
Oh, easily, yeah.
Go ahead.
So I was just going to say, yeah, there's, as we said early on, there's a whole story here. This isn't just, we're chopping this one-third of the way through the real story. The next two stories, which we conceived from the beginning. I mean, the moment we sat down to talk about this particular story, since we were originally thinking movie anyway, you're already thinking, well, at some point, if in success, someone wanted to do a sequel, so what would we be doing beyond that? And there were, as we started dealing with the story right away, we started to see richer, different ways the story could be continued without damaging the first part.
I do think, though, that the first book ends on a pretty satisfying note. I think we've managed to thread the needle in terms of providing closure and a good read without just, flat out. They were designed as three books, so it's not like we just truncated one story and provided a cliffhanger.
Your mileage may vary, but we feel good so far.
Everything you've said sounds fantastic. It sounds really intriguing, really interesting.
Well, we are good talkers.
Yeah. I'm sure you're both aware of the Fermi paradox, the contradiction between the high estimates of probability of life elsewhere and the fact that we've never seen any. What are your own answers or opinions on why E.T. hasn't phoned us yet?
This is David speaking. The universe is an awfully big place, so they may be out there, but the likelihood of us, of them finding us or vice versa. It's the needle in the haystack thing. The other thing is just that the time scale it takes, my own personal feeling, and sadly this is maybe a bit pessimistic, is that there's probably a lot of intelligent life out there, but that most of it ends up destroying itself before they get to the, level that they become spacefaring. That's my opinion. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, David's, Mr. Bright Eyes on some of these things. I think he did touch on one very important point. I mean, the Fermi paradox itself is 100 years old or less. The universe is a big place, and I just don't think humans are equipped, because of the length of our lifespans and our technology at this point, to really make a judgment or have an appreciation of just how difficult and how long we might have to wait to get some real data on that particular subject. I agree with David that intelligent life may have vaporized itself, somewhere nearby or elsewhere in the universe, and that may be a common thing.
I think it's McDevitt, in some of his books, Once We Become Spacefaring, had proposed that they found evidence of, other intelligent life on various planets, but, they're all, the Roman ruins. They've never found anything that was alive yet, which
it's probably the most realistic way to look at it right now if you were to project forward. But one of the fun mind games of science fiction is to say, what if? So we're not proceeding from the fact that the Fermi's rules apply or control everything. We certainly acknowledge it. In fact, we deal with that issue exactly in the book to some degree. But
I would say, again, without giving too much away, one of the things we also kind of deal with is the fact that there may be intelligent life out there, but that it may not exist at or live at the same kind of time scale we do.
Interesting. They don't get up early.
Exactly.
But we're always looking for them at night, and they're daytime people. I don't know. I mean,
but if you also think about the, just to go back one more, sort of mind that one more time, the in the universal scale of things, the amount of time that intelligent life has existed on our planet is a blip. I mean, it's less than a blip. The amount of time that intelligent life on our planet has existed and was able to create signals that would propagate, beyond our planet is,
A blip on a blip.
Yeah, a blip on a blip.
Yeah.
So it's uniquely, anthropomorphic to think that to have the hubris to think that if there is intelligent life out there, A, that we would be worth contacting,
right,
or B, that we would be capable of finding it. It may be all over the place, but our tools are just so damn primitive that it'll be hundreds and hundreds of years before we ever find it.
Exactly. We're assuming that it will still communicate in a narrow spectrum of radio waves that we find convenient.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You talked about the I think very laudable desire to spread science fictional ideas to a wider audience. What role do you think science fiction plays in culture beyond just entertainment?
The best science fiction uses allegory to reflect a mirror back on society and talk about things that otherwise, it's a sort of stealth way of communicating themes to an audience without hitting them over the head and having them, reject it outright, in my opinion.
That is one way of science fiction that shapes people's worldviews. I mean, just more practically, you do have the inescapable example of science fiction writers at least positing good futures, bad futures, technological change, sociological change that we have in some sense wound up living through. I mean, yes, 90% of what people predicted and speculated on never happened, but enough of it did that, as for example, space travel. Writers were talking about space travel in science fiction magazines at the early part of the 20th century, and space travel came about in some sense because the sort of the mental and sociological ground had been tilled a little bit already.
Yeah, would we have attended the space race or Sputnik? I mean, maybe we would have, but I certainly don't think it would have happened as quickly if we hadn't had, X amount of decades of amazing stories and, the pulps and the comic books and et cetera, et cetera.
And there's, Robert A. Heinlein's the great example here and his work and people who were fans of his going into the space program and using ideas that were basically from Heinlein stories or Clark stories and making them a reality. So there is that as well.
Didn't they, forgive me if I get this wrong, but didn't they name a crater or a volcano on Mars after Burroughs?
Oh, yeah, Burroughs, yeah. Well, they named it. They named a ton of things on the moon after there's an Earth-like crater that was named for a Clark story.
Right. My point being that these people that are on the bleeding edge of science were obviously influenced by these stories growing up.
Even if the stories themselves, like Burroughs, weren't remotely scientific and were just flat-out romantic fantasies. But I think, the science fiction, fantasy, it opens your eyes and ears in some ways, and has value for that reason.
I agree. I had a note here that even though
all people, you better.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. And if I don't, I better never admit it. I had a note here that even the most frivolous science fiction has inspired people to think about the future in new ways. I think sometimes it's important, even the, you know, more important than the answers are the questions. Elizabeth Baer said recently, and I really agree with her, if you'll pardon the digression, she said that rather than thinking of science fiction as a literature of ideas, she likes to think of it as a literature of testing ideas to destruction. So the emphasis is taken off the novelty of the idea and placed on testing that idea in all its ramifications.
That's exactly it. It's a workshop. It's a simulation. And it's a very, very perceptive thing for her to have said. Good for her. In fact, I would say, to go back to sort of the premise there as well, science fiction at its best is about asking the questions. It's usually when science fiction writers start giving answers that they get boring.
Well said. We're coming up on 40 minutes. Is there anything else that I've neglected to ask you'd like to talk about, or would either of you like to talk about other projects you have coming up?
Well, David has so many projects that that would consume another 35 minutes. I don't really have much else to add. I'm engaged, as David is, on these three stories right now, and that's my primary work at the moment. I'm also involved on, strangely enough, on a panel on the future of the NASA astronaut office, and do some teaching and trying to write some short stories. So that's what I'm doing.
We're proud of the book and the books to come, and it's been, at least for me personally, I've never been involved in this medium before. So it's been really exciting to stretch my wings. Coincidentally, last year I also got involved in video games, and so it's been exciting for me to kind of take some of the tools that I learned in film and television and comic books and apply them in other mediums. But I will say that I do believe that there are some stories that work best as books and others that work better as movies, and so it's exciting to me with these three novels to tell them write as novels first and then adapt. You know, we don't sit there when we're writing the novels and think, oh, this would be good for the screenplay. We make them work as novels, and then later on I'm going to put on my adaptation cap and figure out, okay, well, how would this work as a film?
On the other hand, Michael is always casting the roles. But that's just game playing, you know, for my own tawdry pleasure. So, yeah.
I think all writers cast the roles.
That's right.
I don't.
Yeah. No?
He gets to cast them in real life. There's the difference.
It's funny. It's a trick I have. I don't really. It's funny. I don't know why. I think in screenwriting sometimes it's more beneficial to not do that, because you never know. Certainly with me, at least, you end up changing the sex of the character sometimes, or the race, or who knows what. And so it's better to kind of keep that aspect of it, you know, to not call up a picture of someone in your mind.
But you see, and that's exactly one of the differences between screenwriting and,
you're right,
and novel writing, where you do need to at least have a picture of the person so you can describe or choose not to describe, however. But, you know, you need to at least have some sense of who it is, you know. Is he tall? Is she short? Whatever. It just start from there.
It's going to be an interesting quandary that I'll have to think about moving into the screenplay, because there are... You know, it would be a big movie, it's a big story, and it would be an expensive movie, and there's X amount of stars that will support that kind of budget.
And he will have me with my list of, no, this is she looks like this.
Exactly. But, you know, that's for tomorrow's problem.
Well, with that in mind, are you having to hold back on describing the characters too much?
No. And they're vividly described in the book. It's just interesting that, you know, when we adapt it, there just may be some discussion about, do we make this character race neutral now? It's just all these interesting quandaries that you have to think about that you don't have to think about when you're writing the novel.
And we didn't.
Yeah.
They became as fully fleshed as they should be. I'm joking about the casting because it's really just a place you start anyway. Well, wouldn't it be great if so-and-so was kind of like this person? But then you start writing them and you start having to imagine them in a set in a story, and it becomes something hopefully more unique and more original.
And I'll give you a perfect example. Okay, the primary protagonist in the book is Zach.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when you write the screenplay and Warner Brothers says, you know, we really want Zach to be Angelina Jolie. So then you have to sit there and say,
okay,
well, does that work? Well, you know, God, I really want the movie made. Okay, how would that change? You know, what's the ripple effect of all of that in this story?
That would be a fairly big ripple.
That would be a big ripple.
But you
stranger things have happened. I'll give you a perfect example. The movie Salt was written for a male and was changed, you know, in that case, for Angelina Jolie.
But they didn't change the title to Pepper, which
no,
is what...
No, but in that case, I think it worked out just fine.
Yeah.
But it's just interesting.
Yeah.
Well, when is the book coming out and when is the film coming out?
The book's coming out within the next month.
Yeah, I believe the publication date is July 5th, certainly early July, at your bookstore everywhere, since no city apparently has more than one anymore.
And I can't imagine a film would come out before 2015, which would mean that the trilogy in publication will have been completed by then. The other interesting thing will be I'll have the benefit in adapting the first novel of having at least finished the first draft of the second book.
Yes.
So, there may be some things that I can foreshadow in the screenplay that weren't otherwise have been foreshadowed in the first novel. It's a really interesting adapting, you know, your own work for screen. It's definitely something that I've never been involved in before. So it's interesting.
Well, it sounds fantastic, and it sounds like you both are the right people to do this, and I can't wait for both. So thank you very much. I appreciate you talking to us.
Okay.
The summer of sci-fi is here. This summer, SF Signal is joining forces with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing and Mer Lafferty's I Should Be Writing to bring you a unique trivia contest / giveaway. This is for all of our podcast listeners. Sponsored by Pyre, we have 12 books to give away to 6 winners who will be selected at random from eligible entries. The rules are kind of simple. You have to listen to some podcasts. This podcast is going to feature a trivia question in the next couple of weeks. You'll just have to tune in to find that out. So will the Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing podcast, and so will Mer Lafferty's I Should Be Writing. So each podcast is going to have a trivia question. We're not telling you when, but it's sometime in the next couple weeks. You need to listen to the podcasts, get the trivia questions, answer them, and then email those in. So the rules. Due to copyright restrictions, this contest is open only to residents of North America. In the month of June, all 3 participating podcasts will feature 1 sci-fi trivia question in an episode, so you just have to listen to those episodes. And then to enter the contest, submit your answers to those questions to adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com by midnight on Friday, July 22nd. So that's going to give you, hopefully, I know some people listen to podcasts kind of pushed out a little bit. They don't listen to them when they air. So this gives you plenty of time. You know, you've got until Friday, July 22nd to hear all three podcasts, find the questions, and send them in. When a question is posted, it will be on the show notes for that episode. So when SF Signal posts our question, you'll be able to go to sfsignal.com, click on the podcast post, and see that there's a question. Then you just have to listen to the episode to get the question. Winners will be selected by blind drawing and notified by email before subsequent announcements through the participating podcasts. When you do send in your answers, you have to include your name, your address, phone number, all that good stuff. And that's because, you know, in case there is technical difficulties with the email address or something happens, we want to have a phone number where we can call you and say, hey, you just won some books. So free books, people. If you have any questions, you can go to sfsignal.com. We have a post up there called the Sci-Fi Trivia Summer, or the Summer of Sci-Fi Trivia, something like that. Or you can go to adventuresinscifipublishing.com or ishouldbewriting.com to find out more details. The only other thing is one entry per person. And that's it for us tonight. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can do a couple things to help us out. Number one, tell some friends, or two, or three, or four, or however many friends you have. Tell them, hey, the SF Signal podcast is pretty cool. You should be listening to that. You can also go to iTunes, give us a couple stars, write us a review. That helps boost our signal there. Also, if you subscribe to us via iTunes, that boosts our signal within the iTunes Podio sphere cast thingy, timey wimey wobbly, you know what I'm talking about. So that helps us out. Let's see, next week we have another great interview. We have another great topic for you. So the topic will be on Monday, the interview will be on Thursday. In the meantime, you can always check out sfsignal.com, and there's tons and tons and tons of great content on sfsignal.com, so you should check that out. Also, if you follow John D on Twitter, twitter.com/sfsignal, he tweets all kinds of cool stuff, and including links to the cool stuff on SF Signal, so it's kind of convenient. Save you some time if you, you know, follow him over on Twitter. Check out Lou Anders online. He is also on Twitter as at Lou Anders. And check out Pyre. Pyre Books is Pyre_books on Twitter. So you'll always have cool stuff. They also have a really neat newsletter that you should sign up for. I'm plugging Lou since he was kind enough to do that interview for us. If you're looking for me online, I'm at atfmb.com, twitter.com/atfmb, facebook.com/atfmb, and I read the occasional post for sfsignal.com. So lots of different places you can find me online. If you want to leave us a voicemail, you can do that. The number is 720-277-9082. See, I had to think there for a second. I didn't have it written down. Normally I have it written down right here in front of me. 720-277-9082. Or you can just go on sfsignal.com, leave us a comment on the post, or click the Google widget and have the Google call you, and then you can leave us a voicemail. I am out of here. Hopefully you guys are having a great week, and I will catch you on the next episode. Is that awkward? That sounded awkward. Bye.